Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
It's Wednesday, October 31st, 2012, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Happy Halloween. I'm Mike McKean, director of the Futures Lab at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Here with me in the RJI studio for our weekly take on news and the news media, our Missouri School of Journalism colleagues Lee Wilkins and Charles Davis. Our topics this week: for once, the hype may have been justified. Sandy truly was a superstorm that's devastated the northeastern United States. Still, did TV journalists really need to stand in knee-deep storm surge and constantly remind us that a crane was dangling from a New York construction site? We'll critique the coverage. Social media played their part in keeping people safe and connected, but they were also used to perpetuate hoaxes, some harmless and some not. Election watchers are always on the lookout for what's called the October surprise. Looks like the surprise this time is Sandy. The storm gives President Obama an opportunity to take command days before most of us vote and throws both campaigning and Election Day planning into chaos. Most of the attention has been on the presidential contest, but what about local and state elections? How well have the media covered them? We'll look at the good and the bad. And they're about to pick new leaders in China. The government there doesn't appreciate a story in the New York Times about the riches amassed by the family of the prime minister. Needless to say, our top story is Superstorm Sandy. We won't know the full cost for a while, but lives have been lost, thousands of homes and businesses are flooded, millions of people are without power, and damages will run into the billions of dollars. Cable news dropped everything else to focus on Sandy, and other media gave it the prominence it certainly deserved. TV reporters followed the usual pattern of standing in the rain, snow, wind, and surf to show just how bad a hurricane can be. This time, they included CNN's Ali Velshi, who normally covers business news, but found himself knee-deep in water in Atlantic City, New Jersey.
People ask, why are you standing in the water? Is there some place you can stand that's not in the water? Yes. Yes, there are high spots in Atlantic City. There are high spots everywhere that ever floods. But you know where I'm standing, Piers? I didn't find a puddle in the middle of Atlantic City. This ocean, this river of water, is downtown Atlantic City. It stretches from here all the way almost a mile. Look at this coming through to where you see those lights in the background. That's the boardwalk. That's the Atlantic Ocean. So the point is to tell people this is a real storm. This is really dangerous.
While CNN anchors made noises about staying safe, the network's producers certainly kept him out in the elements. Some in the audience expressed concern. A group of New York fashion bloggers sent this via Twitter. Dear CNN, please let Ali Velshi go inside before he blows away and dies. OMG. Well, Lee, first of all, before we talk about Ali Velshi standing out in the water, what's your overall assessment so far of the coverage of hurricane or tropical storm or post-tropical storm Sandy?
My overall assessment is that this is something that journalists train to do their whole lives. It usually results in some of our best work, despite the occasional silliness. And so far, what I've seen has actually been awfully good, particularly with the understanding that this has hit the New York media market very hard. You've got people who are working off generators. They can't go home. They aren't sure that their own loved ones and property are safe. So you got people under a significant amount of stress doing the best they can to sort of keep us up to date.
Charles?
I was reading some science blogs last night, particularly some meteorology blogs, and it was interesting because they were talking about, with climate change worsening these storms and these storms growing more and more intense, there was a really robust discussion around the topic of when are these storms going to get so dangerous that it's life-threatening to have Ali standing in the middle of the street in Atlantic City. The answer, the scientific consensus, at least on this blog, which was really interesting and full of highly trained meteorologists, was that we are very, very close. So I think there are real ethical, moral concerns with not just putting people in harm's way, but putting people in destruction.
Well, of course, there are ethical and moral concerns. I mean, one of the things about having him out there is in another context, everybody remember, turn around, don't drown.
Yeah.
We tell people, don't drive your car through standing water, moving water. What is he doing? He's standing in the moving water. So we obviously have journalists who are taking some risks. I don't worry about us quite so much because there are crews there, but I worry a great deal about the citizens who are out there with their cell phones and their cameras, sending it all in. I mean, it's great images. Don't misunderstand. But I am really concerned about, especially the people who decide to shelter in place, how many of them made that choice so that they could get their stuff on TV or the web.
And they think, well, if Ali Velshi can stand out there and he can stand up to it, well, then so can I. You know, the networks are going to continue to do this, of course, whether or not it gets to be life-threatening, because this is a true ratings performance boost. I mean, all the networks got big ratings from this, but not just the networks. There was a story on our blog, shows all the way in Chicago, which was at very best was affected minimally by the storm, their ratings for their local news jumped up because of coverage of Sandy. So what you going to do? I think you're going to go where the ratings are. But why? I'll ask you this, Lee. Why do you think the media tend to sensationalize the storms beyond just audience? I mean, obviously people want to see this. We had a post, for example, that I put up from a Christian blog where a guy was saying, you know, I enjoy a good natural disaster, and it shows that I'm a terrible human being. Well, I mean, that's kind of how we are, right?
Well, I don't think it shows that you're a terrible human being, but there have been actual academic studies that say, why do people watch this stuff? And the answer is, nobody's going to like this very much, is if you're not involved in it, it's highly entertaining. You can look at it and see people do funny things. You can look at it and say, oh, there but for the grace of pick your favorite deity, go I. So, I mean, we know that people tune into disaster coverage and read disaster coverage of all sorts for entertainment. It's also one of those things where in the process of entertaining you, we hope we're giving you some useful information.
Yeah, I'm not going to put too sharp a point on this, I suppose, Charles, but it does kind of bother me a little bit that people are now using social media as well to turn these disasters into just one more opportunity for snark. For example, a bunch of tweets the past few days about whether, you know, Romney was blaming Sandy on President Obama or President Obama was blaming Sandy on a YouTube video. All this silly stuff in the wake of something that's truly a disaster.
True. I think the flip side of it, of course, is that journalism also creates tremendous opportunities for empathy. And you saw probably a much larger number of posts, tweets, everything else that were generating sympathy and empathy and support and, of course, charitable relief for the people up the East Coast. This was a very different storm than a very local state disaster, Joplin, for example, which has created national empathy as well. But there are fewer people who could look at Joplin and go, I know somebody there. I have somebody there if they were in Jersey. The entire East Coast of the United States is something where there's probably very few viewers across the country who don't have a loved one or at least a good friend within the eye of the storm. So it was really different in that regard.
In addition to what Charles said, one of the academic studies that I'll be curious to see come out, and it will be a comparison of media coverage of this storm with media coverage of Katrina, with a focus on poverty and a focus on race. I noticed, for example, and I'm not saying that what the Tribune did was bad, but one of the stories that was ran on the Trib, I think it was yesterday or day before, was one of our former residents, Vicky Puckett, has a home on the Jersey Shore, and they were talking to her about why she'd stayed and what all's happened. We'll contrast that to the lower Ninth Ward in New Orleans. And I actually think that in that comparison, there are some really interesting things to learn about how journalists talk about these things and how we as a country talk about this sort of stuff when you get class and you get race mixed in with the discussion.
Well, now you've tried to elevate this conversation, and I do want to talk about newspapers, but let's go back down to a crass level for a second, and let's look at how the newspapers tried to maximize their benefit, and we'll look at some of the front pages. In fact, we've got one that we're going to put up on the screen here. This is from the Asbury Park Press in New Jersey, and it just says devastated with a huge photo of the devastation that's around the New Jersey shore. There were other headlines with
words like despair, no mercy, where do we start in talking about the damage of the storm? And there were a lot of other newspaper front pages you can see by going to the link on our blog. The folks at the museum do a good job of collecting all of those. Can you still make money, improve circulation, do anything to help the bottom line by running these special event front pages like this, Charles?
Oh, absolutely. I remember in Katrina, the Baton Rouge paper, in fact, made so much money off Katrina that a certain Freedom of Information organization that I ran back in that day got a really nice donation from the Baton Rouge paper, which was largely the result of post-Katrina daily special editions. Their circulation ballooned during that period, and they did quite well financially. So it's one of the, I guess, fortunate realities of these sorts of events is that they do create profit maximization in the short term.
Well, and at the risk of elevating the conversation, and this is one of the things that we know that people seek in news, it's called the surveillance function. People want to see what's going on around in their environment. When news organizations get their websites up, Fearless Fosdick, I predict that they will become, in a lot of ways, sort of like community bulletin boards. People will say, you know, have Earth Mover will get rid of your sand, or they will offer to carpool so people can get to their jobs. I mean, there's going to be a whole lot of this sort of thing springing up, and whether or not it should be monetized, I think the chances of it being monetized are great.
We were talking about whether you're going too far with some of the snark on the internet or Ali Velshi standing out in the water. What about some of the criticism we heard from people using the word Frankenstorm to describe Sandy? I mean, it started out apparently, you know, with some meteorologist at a federal weather center in Maryland, and then the Weather Channel picked it up and social media. But after a while, CNN actually banned it. Some newspapers, I think the Baltimore Sun said you can only use it in if you're quoting somebody directly. Can we use words like that going too far? I think of snowpocalypse or snowmageddon or whatever. Should we just stop with these things?
Well, I mean, in a regional snow event that doesn't claim any lives, I think it's very different than something that claims dozens of lives. And I think you noticed over the, about a 48-hour period, Frankenstorm sort of emerged on, particularly on, well, not just CNN, it was on all the networks right. For about 24 hours. And then just as quickly it went away, because I think people saw that this was not some little laugher of a weekend storm that was going to be sort of a page two story, but they realized they were dealing with an apocalyptic event. And so cut the cute at that right. Point.
You talked about, Charles, how social media did allow people to express empathy and support, and that's certainly true. But there were also, as there always are in big events like this, also people taking advantage of social media to perpetuate hoaxes. Now, some of them on Twitter and Facebook were, you know, they're silly, fun stuff. They were clearly Photoshopped. Here's a picture for our video viewers, for example, of the big storm cloud coming over New York, and it's in the form of a Persian cat. Okay,
wait,
nobody's
going to
be
real? Fooled
by that, right? But there were some others that were actually real. There was the servicemen who were standing in front of the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier. Some media organizations said that was them doing it while the storm was coming in. It was actually from a couple of months ago. We also had some cretins like this guy from New York with the Twitter handle Comfortably Smug, who managed to convince some news organizations, again, including CNN for a bit, that the New York Stock Exchange was under 3 feet of water. Now, that's serious stuff. The group folks over at BuzzFeed actually outed this fellow. His name is Shashank Tripathia. Apparently, he's a hedge fund manager. And until yesterday, at least, he was the campaign manager for a New York congressional candidate. He finally quit that job. What do we make of people doing something like that? And that wasn't his only post. That was the most egregious one, basically false reports of how bad things were.
You know, it's the sloppy excesses of a large social network. You can't certainly control the behavior of everybody, so you're going to get the outliers. What I think is really interesting about that episode in particular is it showed the power of the sort of crowdsourced fact-checking to not only call down, because that was very, very quickly debunked online. And then BuzzFeed and others started trying to figure out who is this dude anyway. And wow, within hours, they had identified this guy. And it reminded me, It reminded me of another famous internet troll that BuzzFeed outed about a week ago, who was doing much more creepy and insidious things that were highly offensive. And they outed him as well. And they're becoming, BuzzFeed's becoming sort of this internet police to some extent.
So Leah, is outing him and the fact that he's, you know, obviously lost his campaign job, could lose his hedge fund job enough? Or should we take seriously the calls by some folks in New York that there are times when using social media to spread false reports should be prosecuted criminally?
I think the Supreme Court has said you can't shout fire in a crowded theater. And at some point, somebody's going to edge right up to that. And we're going to have to probably litigate, because I don't think we're going to be able to do it much of any other way, someplace about where this is utterly inappropriate. I mean, since the guy was a hedge fund manager, you have to wonder if he's trying to make money by moving his hedge fund around in a particularly vicious way, because of course, while the New York Stock Exchange was shut down, that doesn't mean China was shut or Japan was shut or the FTSE was shut or the DAX was shut. I mean, stock trading now is a worldwide thing. But the other thing that people need to remember is, you know, Sandy is Sandy, but the original granddaddy of all these hoaxes happened on All Hallows Eve in 1938 with Orson Welles and War of the Worlds. And it's noteworthy for many, many things, among them the fact that it was the beginning of media scholarship, where we tried to figure out why is it that some people react to these things as if they are true and other people sort of figure out pretty quickly, no, it's not.
I still wonder, too, why the media would react to somebody tweeting under the handle of Comfortably Smug and not start asking a few questions before they broadcast that information live. Well, Charles, one other theme that's been emerging from the press coverage of Sandy in the past few days has been this notion that the storm is now hard evidence of climate change and our unwillingness to deal with the consequences. Is it good that the media are focusing on that? Is it scientifically defensible to say that Sandy has been caused somehow by climate change or made worse by it?
No, but it is scientifically defensible to say that it had been made worse by it. Now, causation, in fact, you posted a couple of excellent stories on the blog, which I would recommend to all our readers, that talk very matter-of-factly with a broad array of scientists who say it's definitely an exacerbating factor. Right. And that's the conclusion of these stories. Absolutely fascinating. I was watching last night a couple of news shows on cable television, including a good bit of coverage on the Weather Channel, in which I felt like, for the first time at least, climate change as a topic was treated in an almost matter-of-fact way by on-air personalities. Well, of course climate change is at the table. They interviewed people during the show, and it was brought up not as a okay, we're going to go touch the third rail of American culture in terms of climate change, but instead we're going to talk about this very real thing that we acknowledge exists. And to me, somehow that felt different.
I think, Lee, that we would agree that that's a good thing that we were able to talk about this and that we could agree on what the science was saying. But I wonder if we can go so far as the one columnist on the blog said that this is a true game changer, that it's going to affect how politicians behave. It's going to affect what we expect of our politicians. Maybe I'm a little too cynical to believe that it's a game changer.
Well, I don't know that necessarily, Mike, that it's a game changer. I mean, to me, it's more like the metaphor of, you know, the water that wears away the stone drop by drop. Mm-hmm. You never know exactly which drop it is, but you do know that over time, the shape of the stone changes. And I think that is what is happening here, is that what I like about what's going on is that this is no longer being treated as an isolated event. You've got people who are hooking Sandy up with a drought and then with very unusual weather for the past decade in the part of the country where we all live. And people are trying very hard, both scientifically but also journalistically, to connect those dots. I don't know when the tipping point will happen. I suspect that I will only know by looking in the rearview mirror. But it does raise this issue of what is it that we expect government to be able to do for us in a very distinctive way.
Well, again, here you go elevating the conversation again.
Yeah,
when really, Hurricane Sandy is all about the presidential candidates. Don't you know that? It's messed up their plans. It's messed up the media's narrative of what this last week of campaigning was going to be about. Some journalists are calling Sandy the election's October surprise. It gave President Obama a reprieve from the Romney's up in the polls stories and produced well-timed photo ops of him leading at a time of crisis, such as this one at the headquarters of the Red Cross.
The most important message I have for them is that America's with you. We are standing behind you, and we are going to do everything we can to help you get back on your feet. Earlier today, I had a conversation with the governors and many of the mayors in the affected areas, including Governor Christie, Governor Cuomo, and Mayor Bloomberg. I want to praise them for the extraordinary work that they have done. Sadly, we are getting more experience with these kinds of big impact storms along the East Coast, and the preparation shows.
And it's ironic that Governor Chris Christie, one of Mitt Romney's more blunt and effective surrogates at times, returned the Obama love, thanking the president for all his help. And he's actually going out with him to tour some of the distressed areas in New Jersey today. So I guess the obvious thing to say, Charles and Lee, is that this does show the power of the presidency. Romney's left in Ohio bagging up supplies to send to victims while Obama is touring the devastating areas and talking to folks at the Red Cross.
Well, it shows that often, it probably reminds us all that often we're at the mercy of events we can't control. And it's how we respond to events we can't control that probably makes us look truly presidential or of leadership timber.
Well, so what's going to be the impact, you think, in these last few days of the campaign? And we've seen they had to cancel some events or go to different places. The president, of course, is acting president, as we would expect him to, whether he's running for re-election or not. What do you think the impact's going to be over the next few remaining days until next Tuesday?
I think probably, seriously, the ground game for both candidates is what's going to take pardon the expression, a hit. And I think that we may see some of the impact of that on what we like to call the down ticket, the people who aren't running for president but are running for state rep and those kinds of offices. I think the other thing will be, I agree with a cartoonist that the Tribune printed last night, where for many people, a loss of electricity is also going to mean a loss of television campaign commercials. And actually, I look on that as a good thing.
Not only that, but I think politicians have to be very careful about what ads they're running during times like this. I noticed online yesterday that one of the senatorial candidate in Connecticut, McMahon, was running vicious attack ads the night of the storm against her opponent. And people were commenting on what horrible political strategy that was. What they don't know is, of course, probably they couldn't stop them.
Right.
Those things had been contracted and they were running anyway. But events beyond your control.
Well, speaking about ads, Lee, we want to move on to our next topic, which involves coverage of state and local elections. But we're going to start with a controversy involving ads, and this was at the Seattle Times. Turns out the publisher decided to give free ads to the Republican candidate for governor and also for a campaign involving the gay marriage initiative on the Washington state ballot. Now, the publisher said this was an experiment in proving the value of political ads in newspapers, but more than 100 staff members said in a letter to the publisher they made public that it was a threat to their reputations as journalists.
It was an experiment in stupid, and the publisher won. He's demonstrated to everybody that he was pretty stupid. There's no reason that I can think of for doing that. It's well-trod ground, especially in the Seattle market. What was he thinking?
But I mean, I think it was stupid too, but how is it really any different than endorsing candidates on your editorial pages and giving them free ads? What's the difference there, Charles?
Ad as opposed to an endorsement would be the fundamental difference. I also think, just to play devil's advocate, if you were going to sort of go out on a limb and do this, and you were going to have this experiment, as Blevin said it was, why wouldn't you experiment in a bipartisan way? Why do you do it in a partisan way? That's the part that was
that's
truly bad.
That's the part that's got me completely gobsmacked, to quote one of my friends in the UK. It makes no sense. And the thing about an endorsement is that an endorsement is supposed to have reasons behind it. You can disagree with the reasons, but this was out and out advertising.
Well, let's turn our attention to the local situation here in Missouri. And I had asked each of you to come up with an example of a story that you thought represented quality journalism covering state and local elections. And Lee, let's start with your example.
Okay, so I'm going to go back to the endorsement thing. I read the editorials in the Tribune, and I frequently agree and frequently disagree. But I thought that Hank did a masterful job of actually doing some reporting about the controversy surrounding the John Wright, Mitch Richards local race. He actually went out, he talked to people, and they didn't hang up the phone on him. He quoted what they said in his editorial about the endorsement. And you don't often see that kind of reporting in an opinion piece, but I thought it was a fabulous job, and I'm very grateful for it.
And Charles, your example was also from the Tribune, so tell us a little bit about it.
Yeah, kudos to the Tribune for doing some nice, this was some nice sort of digging behind the scenes in which they eventually identified Mr. Barry, a candidate who's running against the incumbent Weber for state rep, and apparently doing a pretty poor job of it. And he was outed as the owner of some particularly noxious comments on, I think it was a Tea Party forum, that were attributed to his Facebook and Twitter handle. His response was to say that some devious anonymous hacker group had apparently done this, which is fairly hard to believe. But it's a remarkably good job, I think, of digging.
And Lee, an example of what you'd like to see more of before we get to next Tuesday.
Okay, so I pray so. Now I'm gonna throw mud. I'm disgusted with every single media outlet in town on the lack of coverage of the Hensley-Hartler congressional race. That has just been abysmal. I mean, I can't come up with enough predicate adjectives to describe how sloppy, lazy, ahistoric. I mean, there's been nothing good about it. And shame on all of us. We can do better than this.
Well, I'd also like to see just across the ballot, I'd like to see a lot more reporting in the last, I mean, we should have been doing it all along, but more reporting of the claims made in local ads. I mean, you're seeing attack ads at the state, not only the state, you're seeing it at local elections, which I find reprehensible, frankly. And I would love to see a fact check of every last claim made, not just of the president and Claire McCaskill, but of really local politics.
Well, and in fact, because we are not a battleground state for the presidency this year, there's a lot more local advertising and state advertising on the air to perhaps influence us. So I think you're right, we should do more of that. I'm going to mention just a couple of online sources that I would point our listeners and viewers to. Something called Project Open Vault, which is jointly sponsored by KBIA, KOMU, and the Missourian, and local data journalist and professor David Herzog. They're showing everything from campaign spending, at least, on advertising by mid-Missouri candidates. They have in-depth candidate interviews from the KBIA staff. The Missourian's even asking, what is the most confusing ballot issue in this year's general election? And the reporters plan to answer, you know, those questions, provide some insight into things that are confusing on the ballot. Good for them. Another thing that they're doing is an election night virtual watch party. You can see it on the screen if you're watching. Here's Ruben Stern of Intersection.
Oh, and I like the hat.
He's wearing a party hat because we have created or in the process of creating a web app where readers, viewers, listeners can get on through social media that we've set up and have a conversation virtually about the elections. Well, we're not going to have time to get to our last story, which was the story about the candidates in China. Well, not candidates, the party picking the leaders in China, and a fascinating, great New York Times business story about how the family of the current prime minister has raked in billions and billions of dollars. I just encourage you to read the story. There's a link on our blog, and especially the transparency shown by David Barbosa, because he answers readers' questions about whether or not documents were leaked to him and such. But that's going to have to be it for today's show. I want to thank our technical crew. That would be Travis McMillan and Pat Akers. Thanks also to you for listening or watching. You can go to our blog and you can find out more links to our interesting articles and video. You can also leave comments, questions there, or you can do so via email at views@kbia.org. I would also like to suggest to you that you please go vote next Tuesday, and then after you do that, please join Charles, Lee, and me next Wednesday for our 2012 post-election edition of KBIA's Views of the News. We'll be up all night.